Hello, my name's Tamsin Westhorpe and welcome to Fresh from the Pod Gardening Stories. Very few of us have managed to get through the last year without our mental health being impacted in some way. In Mental Health Awareness Week, I was really keen to talk to someone who had experienced the power of nature as a way of healing and helping. Hannah Powell, comms and HR director of Perrywood Garden Centre in Essex, generously shares with me her story and explains why she is so passionate about raising awareness of mental health issues within the horticultural industry and beyond. Hannah, thank you so much for joining me on Fresh from the Pod. I'm really keen to talk to you in Mental Health Awareness Week because you are in the horticultural industry. We're all very aware of how hobby gardening is so good for us, but what's it like to be in the industry? So can you explain to me a bit about your family business, which is very much in the heart of the horticultural industry?
Sure. So it's a business that's been in my family for three generations. My grandparents bought a four-acre small holding in North Essex near Tiptree, where the jam comes from, in 1955. And my grandparents really lived off the land. My granddad had been a stockman on a local estate before that. And they had a few cattle. They had pick-your-own strawberries, potatoes, a lot of weeds apparently, and they really lived off the land. And then my parents bought the business from them in 1984, and we moved on site. We swapped houses with my grandparents, moved all our belongings in a tractor and trailer, as you do. And there was my mum and dad, and then myself and two younger brothers. I was six at the time, and my brothers were four and two. And then after that, I suppose in the 30 years from 1984, my mum and dad built that small holding into a garden centre, and it is now Perrywood Tiptree is now one of the best garden centres in the UK. And it's not just me saying that, we are number three in the Garden Centre Association league table of UK garden centres, which is incredible. And we've also got a second garden centre in Sudbury in Suffolk, which we bought September 2018 as well. So I think the thing that I suppose has carried on through those three generations, and I now work in the business with my dad. My mum's retired a few years ago, but my dad is very active in the business, and I also work with my two brothers as well. So we've all come back into the business, and the thing that's still there all these years later is that we are potty about plants. So that kind of growing heritage has really stayed with us. We have stuck to that. We still have a production nursery. We grow 750,000 bedding plants every year. And that's what we all love about the business. And yes, we've got the giftware and the coffee shop, which are all fantastic, but the plants really are at the centre of the business, if you like.
Crikey. So you must have quite a few staff to look after.
Yeah. So I think we've got about 170 at Tiptree and about 30, I think there's a few more now, at Sudbury. So yeah, about 200 in total.
So your role is HR and communication, am I right? So you are really looking after people.
That's right, yeah. So before I came back into the business, I had a career in PR and marketing. So I came back into the business and it was very natural for me to take on a communications role. But then I realised that actually alongside that and alongside being passionate about plants, I'm actually passionate about people. So I love developing people. I have a very, and I think my whole family does, but I have a very clear sense of kind of fairness and wanting to treat people the way I want to be treated, treating others the same way. And that sense of being a family business, that our team is more than just not a number, that they are a part of the Perrywood family. And we, you know, there may be 200 of them, but they're still, you know, very important to us. So I think taking on that role was a natural progression for me. I've employed an HR manager. I'm not, you know, an expert in HR, but I think what I do is care a lot about the people and want to bring in initiatives to support them in their, you know, physical, mental well-being.
And you're passionate about sharing the importance of looking after our mental health because you've had experiences yourself. Tell me when you first started to experience a deterioration.
Sure. So I had a bout of depression in 2001. I'd suffered a series of bereavements. And, you know, I'd never been to a funeral before. And suddenly I'd been to three funerals. And one of them was one of the Perrywood family who died when he was only 26.
Gosh.
So that one really affected me, as well as losing my grandfather. And also my dad lost a friend of his. So suddenly I had a sense of my parents' mortality as well. And my mental health just completely dive bombed. I think I took a week off work. Maybe I should have taken more. But that was my first experience. And I went to a bereavement counsellor, and that was the way that I got out of it. But also, I was living in London at the time, and I remember calling home and being, you know, rather downbeat on the phone to my mum. And she would always say, "Right, have you been for a walk today?" No, you know, go on, get out. And I have to go on, you know, you feel better. And I trudge up the hill to Tooting Common, and by the time I got there, you know, my shoulders had relaxed. I felt a bit more hopeful again, and I think that was the first time I really realized how important plants and greenery and nature was to me, and that I needed it around me. Having grown up on a garden centre, it is literally part of my ecosystem. You know, people talk about having green thumbs. I'm green all the way through, and I need that around me. And when I don't have that, and I'm sure, you know, lots of listeners to this podcast will relate to that, I crave it and I need it.
So do you put that down to a lot to do with bereavement, but were you very stressed at work as well? Was it a mixture of other things?
I'd only just, so to, what was it, 2001? So I'd only just moved to London. I'd been travelling not long before that. So not really. I think I was still finding my way in the world. I had done a degree in horticulture. I had kind of thought, maybe should I be going back into the family business? I never felt pressure from mum and dad, but I suppose I had that internal pressure of, you know, should I be going back there? Should I not? But I think it was at that time, it was the bereavements. I then went on in 2008, 2009 to be extremely unwell. I was diagnosed with something called a functional neurological disorder. Right. And the depression came back at that point. And at that point, I would say that, yes, I was very stressed. I was working from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. I had quite high pressure jobs. I was, you know, working hard, and I was playing too hard as well. I drank too much. I was binge drinking at the weekends. You know, I really wasn't, you know, my London life, I didn't really look after myself. You know, every night there was someone to go to the pub with. We didn't always eat a meal. You know, we were, you know, having a great life, but it caught up with me.
It does. And with that disorder, there's physical implications, aren't there, sometimes?
Yes, absolutely. So I had there's a whole range of symptoms that people can get. The ones that I got were quite bad twitches. And when I say twitches, it was where my whole torso and my arms would move in reaction to sound. In reaction to touch, so actually just stepping my feet along the ground would set off the twitches at its worst. Picking up a piece of paper wow. when it was really bad would set it off. I had a tremor in my right hand, and just, yeah, my body was kind of, the way I would describe it is that my nervous system got stuck on high. You know, when you think of that kind of fight, flight or freeze, I was kind of in flight mode. The whole time I was reacting like that piece of paper was, you know, a bullet coming towards me. Do you know what I mean? My body was just totally oversensitive to everything. So it was quite, it was life changing, to be honest. I took 6 months off work that time and found a way to get better. And that involved, again, more counselling, acupuncture, cranial osteopathy. But the big thing that I found related to what we're talking about is again, I came back to nature. So I was living in a flat in London by the Thames. Every day I forced myself to get outside, and that was no mean feat when the walking was causing the twitches.
Yes.
But I made myself get out, and I made myself take one good photo every day. And it was the nature photos that really inspired me and made me get out there day after day. You know, the birds nesting, the leaves changing colour, or the springtime leaves coming out, or the flowers in a crack in the pavement. It was those small details that other people were just walking past because they had somewhere to be. I had nowhere to be. I had lost my mojo. There was no reason to get out of bed and get dressed. But those photos literally kept me hanging on. And I can't emphasize how important enough that was to me at the time, as well as family and friends and all the other support I had. But it was my own little journey, I think, that I needed.
That must have been terrifying, to have physical implications as well as mental. I mean, to get over that, it must have been, well, and I take it you're much better now.
Absolutely. I it's funny because I've been writing a book about it over the last few months, and I think at the start of writing the book, I would describe myself as fully recovered. But in researching some things for the book, I've been looking up about FND, because at the time I had it, there wasn't much information about it. There's a lot more information now. It's still not as well known as it should be. More people have it than MS and Parkinson's. Crikey. But it's still not something that a lot of people know about. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but we'll circle back if needs be. But the diagnosis journey was quite long and stressful. But yes, now I don't have any of those symptoms. I don't get the twitches. I do occasionally feel sensitive in my feet if I've been walking a lot. Sometimes my thermostat doesn't work properly if I go to very hot countries or I'm in very cold. I don't cope very well. I have kind of brain foggy days. But, you know, that could be other things. That could be age, that could be stress, it could be all sorts of things. You know what, yeah. I mean? So it's difficult to tell sometimes, but I've never gone back to work full time, but I do have a daughter. So I'm not sure I would have anyway. And I'm a director of two companies. I run a household. You know, I have good days and I have bad days, but so does everyone, don't
you? Yeah, quite a busy lady.
I'm in a pretty good place. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad to hear it. But I'm interested to hear, when you sort of admitted to friends and family that you were unwell, what was their reaction? I mean, were you kind of nervous of telling people, you know, I'm suffering from a mental illness?
It's interesting. The first time I had depression, no, I don't think so, because that was related to a bereavement. So it was kind of okay. It was like, yeah, I had a reason. So I don't think there was too much stigma around it. And certainly my colleagues were extremely supportive. I remember people, you know, taking me for a walk around the block when they could see I was having a down day, or we'd go on a night out and they could kind of tell I didn't want to go home on my own. So they'd say, look, come back to my flat, you know, crash there for the night. They'd make me laugh. You know, there was a lot of support. The second time, no, I never really experienced kind of stigma, or I think there was a lack of understanding, as I had a lack of understanding. And also because it took quite a long time to be diagnosed. And in that time, you know, the consultants had to tick everything off or else off the list. So they were ticking off, you know, have you got epilepsy? Have you got MS? Have you, you know, I had to have the MRI machine and the EEG and all the other tests. So there was quite a scary time when my friends and family and me didn't know where this was going. Was it going to get worse? Would it get better? But no, certainly I've never felt stigma as such around it, thankfully.
Do you think you're quite good now at picking up other people's vulnerabilities? Do you notice things in people that makes you think, oh, crikey,
I'm worried,
yes,
for you?
Yes, definitely. And I think once you've had that epiphany, if you like, you know, I was working, and then had the most dramatic kind of way of realising I wasn't looking after myself. So I probably do notice it in other people. But you have to, other people can tell you whether I manage this or not, but I try not to impose my thinking on them, but I might softly mention what happened to me or give some suggestions of self-care, etc. But I try not to be too full-on about it, because it is something I'm very passionate about, but I don't want to overwhelm people, and I don't want to tar them with my brush either. Everyone's different, aren't they, and they have to go on their own journey of understanding. But yes, I do notice it in other people.
So you write a blog called The Cactus Surgeon, and you've written this wonderful book, an e-book, My Green Recovery. And I've obviously looked at your website and your blogs, and I think it's such a good thing that you're doing. You're making such a positive thing of sharing how people can get through this by doing very, very simple things. But I wanted to ask you, because it's a term that's used a lot now, is mindful gardening. What? How would you define that? Because I think a lot of people go, what on earth do you mean? You know, but what would be your definition?
So I did a mindfulness course a few years ago, and I've never really got on very well with the concept of sitting down and doing mindfulness. It's not kind of active enough for me, and I'm maybe not very good at sitting still for that long, and kind of focusing on me. Maybe I shy away from that still now. But what I would describe it as is it's the same, you know, whether you're into reading or music or art or gardening or whatever it is, it's that thing where you're concentrating on something so much that you're not thinking about anything else. In the same way that in those early walks I took in London that helped me get through my illness, you know, those negative thoughts just kind of peel away, and you're just looking, you're in the moment. You're not thinking, you're not worrying about the past, you're not dwelling on the past, you're not worrying about the future. You are absolutely in the moment. You are looking at that ladybird crawling on that leaf in front of you. You have got your hands in the soil. You know, you're listening to the bird song, and you're just there. And it is, for me, it is, I hesitate to use the word spiritual, but it is a kind of all body kind of experience for me when I'm out there. And, you know, my husband will say, you know, you just look so happy when you're out there. You know, you just look very comfortable out there when you're gardening. And I do get a craving for that. I miss it if I'm not out there, I haven't been out there for a while.
Yeah, and I think that's the sort of connection that people found with gardening, wasn't it, through the lockdown? You know, hobby gardeners actually thought, gosh, this is really making me feel better. Have you seen that in your customers? Have you seen much more people, younger people, different people coming to the garden centre?
Yes, I think we're in the home counties. We're on a, you know, there's a commuter line not far from, you know, 5 minutes from the garden centre at Tiptree. And certainly there, we're seeing a lot more younger people in the week who would probably be in London normally in the week, whereas they're now working from, and I say younger, actually, I can go right up to whatever age, can't it? So it's not about age, but a lot of commuters that would normally be in London that are now working from home, and they're popping out in their lunch break to come and shop with us. So certainly in the week, the audience is much younger. And we've also set up a Facebook group this year called Growing with Perrywood 2021, because we wanted to harness that enthusiasm and actually bring people together. So some people who have been gardening for years, but link them up with people that don't have that knowledge. So we are getting people on that group saying things like, you know, I sowed seeds for the first time last year and I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm absolutely loving it. And then other people chip in and go, oh, keep going and don't worry about that because that happens to me, and do this and don't do that. And it's fantastic to bring those groups, you know, together. So yes, we're definitely seeing it, I would say.
And I think it's lovely to see so many different initiatives and ideas, because Candide, that do the podcast with me, they're celebrating the benefits of gardening for the entire month of May with their Festival of Flowers, with all sorts of activities and gardening tips. And I think there's been a lot of that, a lot of people wanting to share, because they get as much out of sharing mentally as the other people, don't they? Giving advice.
Definitely. And I also think there is something about the act of sharing what you're doing that reiterates the positivity of it. It's a bit like doing a gratitude journal at the end of the day. And I think that's why the best of Instagram and social media is people that are sharing these positive moments. And by sharing a photo or a tweet, or on a Facebook group, wherever it is, you're kind of saying to yourself that something good has happened that day.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. I think you will feel much more positive about it as a result.
And that's why your book, My Green Recovery, it's, you know, it's such a valuable thing you've done to share that. It's amazing. Now, I wanted to bring up a headline that I read in Horticultural Week in April that really made me sort of sit back and think, wow, it was why the gardening industry has a mental health crisis. And I thought, do you know what? This is such an interesting headline. I couldn't not read this because I'm in the horticultural industry. I garden every day. A lot of my friends are nursery men and women or florists. And a lot of people have had incredibly challenging times during the pandemic. You know, they've not been able to do their wedding flowers. They've not been able to sell their plants. So I was really keen to talk to you about this because everyone assumes if you're a gardener, you've got nothing to complain about. But how do you see it, having all those staff that work incredibly hard for you?
It's been a really hard year. And I'd say it's been one of the most challenging things for our business over the years. You know, we've had events in the past with, you know, the recession and hurricane destroying greenhouses and hard winters and things like that. But I think this pandemic has been one of our biggest, or if not the biggest challenge. And I think for me, I really have felt the weight of responsibility of looking after those 200 people. Now, of course, I'm not responsible for their individual, you know, lives, but I think as a business, you know, we have had and a responsibility to look after them, obviously, to keep them safe in the workplace, but also to provide a bit more support around their mental well-being, their physical well-being during this difficult time. And I think, you know, one of the things I mentioned to Matthew in the article was that the NHS, you know, doing a fantastic job at the moment with the vaccination programme, and that's, you know, helping us all. But I think in terms of kind of access to GPs and waiting times, there's a lot that's wrong at the moment. And I think employers are increasingly having to pick that up. So, for example, we have an employee assistance programme so that people can phone a helpline 24/7, 365 days a year for free and get either kind of advice around anything from debt, worries, health, legal, anything, relationships, anything that might be troubling them, they can call up. And if they think they need it, they can be referred to free counselling sessions every year as well. And I see that as a kind of good gap, because if you go to the NHS, you're probably going to have to wait for counselling. Unless it's, you know, incredibly urgent. So through that EAP, we can kind of give that support in the meantime. Or if you need an operation, you're probably going to have to wait for quite a long time to have that if it's a routine operation. But it might be causing you stress in the meantime. So if we can, again, give you some counselling, or we can send you to occupational health to get the, you know, to help you make some adjustments in the workplace while you're waiting for that operation, then that's going to be really valuable. And through the pandemic, having those resources, you know, we are able to send people to occupational health, for example, if they're suffering anxiety in the workplace. And for some people being on furlough and then coming back into the workplace where there are customers around, you know, we've put lots of protocols in place, you know, working behind barriers, plastic screens, etc. But, you know, not all customers will follow the guidelines, and it can be quite stressful for people working in that retail environment. So it's been quite important to us to just provide that extra support.
I run an open garden, and I'm front facing dealing with customers coming in, and the first week I opened, I actually thought, I don't know how to speak to people. It was really weird. You can't remember what you used to do. You don't have the communication skills you used to have. I'm getting there, and I think we all are. But I think, you know, customers don't always see the person that's serving them, that, you know, they've been through the pandemic as well. We've all been affected in some way. But have you found that anxiety is an issue for your staff, have you heard that this is more of an issue for people?
Yes, I think for some people it is a real challenge, and it's how you can support them through that. And I think, you know, I think there is still that thing of, if someone, you know, breaks a leg and is off for 6 weeks, you know, people are still more understanding of that, aren't they, than if someone maybe is anxious and is off for a few weeks. And we try and make it so they don't need to So there isn't that stigma. You know, I talk quite openly in newsletters about my own mental health problems in the past. So that, you know, well, if a director can have mental health problems, you know, it's okay for me to have mental health problems. It's kind of just making it normal to talk about it. And I think anxiety is, you know, it's important to just have it out in the open. Not that people need to share their individual problems if they don't feel comfortable to, but knowing that they can if they need to, and knowing they've got a good manager to go and talk to. Is really important. We've just done some training of mental health first aiders as well, so there's another group of people in the business that are trained to look out for signs of mental health issues, etc.
That's brilliant. But do you think that horticulture, I mean, it's very sort of traditional for small businesses, small nurseries, for people just to have to crack on, whether they feel exhausted or depressed, you know, there's sometimes no other option. So if you're running a sort of two-man band, you can't sort of fall by the wayside. What do you think is the way round that? How do those people manage?
It's really difficult because I have the luxury of, we're now at a scale where, you know, I've been able to employ an HR manager. I've been able to have an EAP. I have to say, some of the things, like having an employee assistance program, I think I would have done a lot earlier had I known about them. They're not actually that expensive per person. And same with occupational health. Actually, yes, you might have to shell something out, but you're going to get more out of your team member, and you're going to resolve a situation much more quickly. So you're going to get that value back.
So it's really how these smaller businesses, if one of them is feeling unwell, what advice would you give them, having been through what you've been through?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have an open conversation, to have an open culture, that your team, whether it's one person or 10 or 100, that they are able to come and talk to you. And there are, you know, there's things like Perennial out there, aren't there, that support the industry as well. So that there are charities and things out there. So often it's about signposting to support. So even if you as a company are too small to give that support, actually there's loads of things out there. There's things like Access to Work and Able Futures, which are both government funded schemes where you can get funding and support for people with physical or mental health problems. So for example, if someone breaks a leg, they could get funding for a taxi to work. Obviously not great in horticulture, but if you're in an office job, that would be helpful. We've had funding for coaching for people with dyslexia, to help them and their team members understand how to get the best out of them and how to work around some of the things that they find difficult. Able Futures will give 9 months of support to people with mental health problems, and that's all, you know, for free. Some of the we had to pay for some of the dyslexia coaching, but only about 10% of it or something. So actually, as a small business, if you don't have the fund, you can access things like that. And so I think, you know, spend an hour one day Googling and researching what's out there that could help you. You know, what are the charities doing? Mind is a fantastic resource. They've got some brilliant mental health at work work plans that you can go through with your employee, and it will ask them, you know, what are your triggers in the workplace? What could we do differently when you're feeling stressed to stop you getting depressed, getting anxious? You know, and all those resources are available for free. So I think sometimes it's about just spending the time on it. And I totally accept that if you've got a small nursery and, you know, April, May, and especially at the moment with demand, it is really hard to find that time to stop. But I promise you, it will be worth it. You won't regret it.
And I suppose if you don't, it just gets worse, doesn't it? And you might not find
absolutely
a way out
and
of it.
Yeah, and you might have a team member that's then off for 6 months, whereas if you'd got in there early and helped them get that support, and again, it's up to them whether they want to take that support. You cannot force them. But if you lay those options in front of them and keep an open dialogue with them, they are more likely to access that support, and maybe they'll be off for a shorter time. So you will benefit, I think, over time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the wonderful thing about horticulture is I've met numerous people that have given up their stressful office job. I mean, a bit like me, I was editing a magazine and I've gone back to sort of being on the tools gardener. It slightly worries me that people who may suffer from mental health issues think, right, I'm going to give up my job, going to give up what I know, and I'm going to start a new career in gardening, and it's going to make me well. I mean, it does. It can do, because you're obviously outside with nature. But it's not a career that doesn't come with, it doesn't come without stress, does it?
No, and I think it depends what horticulture you're talking about. You know, even as a, if you look at floristry, for example, you could do a bit, you know, if it's not a monetary thing, if you, you know, I don't know, you've got a partner that's earning more money, you could do it as a kind of more hobby lifestyle thing, right up to doing weddings for thousands of people. You know, there's different amounts of stress, aren't there? Mm. And it's the same in garden centres. You know, you could go and work for a garden centre where you only get, or a nursery where there's only, you know, a handful or 100 customers a day, or you could work for a garden centre like ours, that the pace that we work at is incredibly fast and it's very physical. You know, a lot of our team are doing 20 to 30,000 steps a day at the moment. So that is physically very wearing as well. So I think people just need to go into the job with an open mind and think about what kind of organisation am I going into, and ask questions at the interview. I think sometimes people forget that, yes, the company's interviewing them, but you need to interview the company as well. What have they got in place to support people? You know, what pace do people work at? And, you know, make sure you find a match for you. But yeah, certainly I know that going to work, every time I'm at work, I will go for a walk through the plant area at least once or twice, because I love going around and chatting to the team and seeing how they're doing, but also just being out there with those plants. I mean, how can you not smile? You know, we're lucky enough at Tiptree, we've got a beautiful woodland behind, and the birds are singing, you know, the bees are buzzing, and it just lifts your spirits. So it's a nice place to be, but absolutely not without its stresses.
Yeah. No, I think that's very sensible advice. Now, something else that was in the article in Horticulture Week was a study that was taken place by, I'm going to say this wrong now, Leibunsky. Is that right? Do you remember? No. Yeah. Apologies to study. But it was very interesting. They're just saying that 50% of your happiness is genetic.
And the environment is 10%, and 40% is the way you think. So do you accept that? Do you think that's, I mean, obviously it's a, I don't know how the study was done, like you, but do you think that's a fair sort of distribution of percentages?
Yes, sorry, I know the one you mean now. Yes, no, I did read about that. I think that is fair, actually, and I think people put too much emphasis sometimes on that 10% of environment. And I don't by environment, from what I read, they weren't talking about you know, getting out into the countryside. They're talking about literally your kind of the environment around you, the house you live in, etc. And I think, you know, we do probably spend too much time on materialistic things sometimes, and it's, but what encouraged me was the 40% is the way you think and your mindset.
Yeah,
and that's the bit you can change. So changing the environment around you is quite difficult. You might, you know, not have the funds to move to where you really want to. You might be on a busy road and you'd love to be in the village, but you can't for whatever reason. You know, your partner might not want to live where you want to live. You're kind of stuck with that, maybe. But the mindset, you know, if 40% of being happy is about your mindset, yes, you can work on that. And isn't that fantastic that you've got that ability to change your mindset? And I certainly have done that myself. I've always been quite a positive, optimistic person, and obviously that optimism got shaken when I was depressed and ill.
Yeah.
But my mindset, I'm far more focused now on finding the small wonders in nature. And also I engineer those small wonders around me as well. I don't just wait for them to come along. I go out and find them, or I, you know, put things in certain places so that I can view them from the window, so that when I'm washing up, I can see things. When I'm in the office, I can see things. I have things on my desk to look at. You know, I'm not leaving it to chance. I know that those things make me happy. So I think there's a lot we can do in our lives to be happier.
Yeah, I think that's lovely that we, you know, that study showed that, because I can see, the listener can't see, but you've got houseplants on your desk. And, you know, having houseplants around you, cut flowers, it's got to make a difference, hasn't it? But are you seeing in your sales in the garden centre, did you see over lockdown more houseplants being bought?
Honestly, so when the kind of houseplant boom, if you like, when houseplants came back into fashion, we still had quite a big houseplant greenhouse, whereas other garden centres have kind of shrunk them down to being next to the tills and things like that. But we've all the way along, we've kept houseplants. But now the sales are phenomenal. We still can't, I mean, we are keeping up with it, but we got a new range of cactus in the other day that were flowering and really interesting, and they were all named, and literally they flew out within a couple of days. People are buying really big specimens. People are buying the rare stuff that's really expensive. You know, they'll pick up a Calathea white fusion, is it, for $64.99, you know, and it is just continued. And I think people just need that around them in their houses, don't they? And I think not only to look at, but also something to care for.
Yeah,
I think it's that taking that money out of their day to water it, and, you know, dust the leaves, and stroke it, talk to it, whatever you want to do with your plants. I think that gives people, again, those small moments outside of their, you know, you're not thinking about the negative news and the pandemic. You're just thinking about your plants. And I think that's been really important to people. So, yeah, it still seems to be continuing. It's not showing any signs of slowing down at the moment.
And do you put that down to... I put it down to obviously people wanting to be close to nature in their home, but also it's the Instagram world, isn't it? You know, people showing their homes with beautiful big plants. And that's why I think they want to buy the bigger specimens. Because when I've been shopping at garden centres like you, I'm amazed that people are buying the big plants, because they're not cheap. But it's like they've made that investment in their mind. I'm going to have this. And it's going to be my baby, you know, I'm going to look after it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think maybe they started with some smaller ones and then they have success, so they kind of get bigger and bigger. But yeah, it is the kind of statement show ones, I think, are a lot about social media. And I think just the fact that more people are spending time in their homes and they're sitting there and then seeing those spots, and it does get addictive. You know, I've got hundreds of plants around my house, but I'll still sit there and think, oh, that spot looks a bit bare. And even my husband, so we've been living here for nearly 10 years, and to start with he's like, oh god, you're going to fill the house with plants, it's going to be like a jungle. But even he sometimes says, oh, we could do with a plant over there. I'm like, yes, I've converted him, this is great.
Yeah, and other things like I've noticed, you know, my sister, who's not a gardener, is spending more money on garden furniture, garden games. It's making the garden such an important part of our lives. But do you worry that as soon as we can all go off on holidays, that people will abandon that? Or how are you feeling, you know, as a business? Do you think that it'll be a continued...
It's not sustainable at this level. And inevitably, we will lose people back to pubs and, I don't know, whatever their hobbies are that they're not able to do at the moment or haven't been. You know, some have opened up, haven't they, like golf and things like that, people are back to. But we will lose some people. But what we think is, well, if we gain, you know, if we can keep 10% of that group, then that's brilliant. And that's what we're trying to do in store and through our social media, is keep that enthusiasm going, give them inspiring projects to do, make sure, as I said, we're linking them up with people that know what they're doing, and just keep that excitement going. But yeah, we're not expecting everybody to stay buying and purchasing at this level. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Be great for business.
It would be great. Yeah, it would be great. I wouldn't mind. But yeah, I think the industry needs time to catch up as well. You know,
yeah,
we're struggling to get plants and furniture and other products. So I think over the summer, when everyone's focused on hospitality for a bit, maybe that'll be a chance for the industry to catch up. And maybe it's good for people's mental health as well, just have a bit of quiet time.
Yeah. So really, just to end, what would you say to someone that's never gardened before but is suffering with a mental health issue? How would you persuade them? You know, if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, yeah, I'm not keen on gardening, I don't buy it, what would you say to them to get them out there?
Well, first of all, ditch the word gardening, because I think that turns a lot of people off.
Gosh, that's interesting.
So I would just think about, yeah, we try not to talk about gardening actually as a garden centre too much, because I think the word conjures up a certain way of being in your garden. It's like hard work in a way.
Yeah.
So what I would talk about is get some more nature in your life, get some more greenery in your life, bring the outside in. And again, think about the way you use your home, whether it's windowsills inside, doorways outside, you know, the places that you pass by a lot. You know, having something on your doorstep that's fragrant, for example, that you brush past, like a rosemary or, you know, lavender or something like that, you know, you're going to get a lot of sensory kind of pleasure from that. So start with something small and see how you go. And maybe speak to friends that are already into it. You can get free cuttings and things. You know, it doesn't have to be expensive. You can start small, so you're not kind of spending too much on it and not thinking, oh, this is going to be a waste of time and money. You know, just start small and see where it takes you.
And I think what's been really healthy through the pandemic is people have grown an awful lot from seed, far too much from seed, and they've been giving their seedlings and baby plants to friends. And I think that's a great way of hooking someone in. So if I have a friend that's a non-gardener that I think they could do with this hobby in their lives, I think presenting them with a sort of tray of possibilities is just got to be a good thing, hasn't it?
Oh, definitely. As you say, seeing something grow from a tiny seedling up into a chili plant with ripe chilies or whatever it is, it's just the best feeling in the world, isn't it? And you can, and someone can say, you know, I've grown that. I know my daughter's school has sent them all home a couple of weeks ago with the sunflower seed in a newspaper pot. Mm. And it's such a simple thing, but they will all, you know, get something, or a lot of them will get something out of that experience, and they can say, I grew that. And that's just wonderful.
Yeah. And I think horticulture is so broad. I've got a teenage son and I bought him some carnivorous plants, and it really hooked him in. He was like, oh, these are really cool. And they're out in the rain now. He keeps moving them in and out. It's trying to find that thing. So it might be that, you know, your partner's into cooking, so like you say, get chili plants, get them growing herbs and exciting things like that. Gosh, I mean, it's not a small hobby, is it? There's so many different aspects.
That's what I love about it, because, you know, I'm still learning, I'm still enjoying it, and there's always something different to do, as you say. So, yeah, long may it continue.
Yeah, well, it's been wonderful to talk to you, and I think the fact that you share your experience is hugely generous. And I'm sure it helps so many people. So thank you for that. And I hope your summer is very successful at the Garden Centre.
Thank you. No, I'm sure it will be. We've got an amazing team there, and they do a great job. So, yeah, thank you very much.
So if people want to sign up for your newsletter, read your blogs, where should they go, Hannah?
Sure. So if you search for The Cactus Surgeon, I should probably explain why The Cactus Surgeon as well, just very quickly.
Yes, please
when
do.
When I was six... Yeah. So when I was six and living at the garden centre, I used to want to be a cactus surgeon. I'd sit at the windowsill with my mum and dad's cactuses, and if they got a rotten patch, I would kind of gouge it out with a knife and hope that it would survive. So it was just a bit of fun. It was something that I'm putting in my memoir, and I thought actually it's quite a unique title. So if you Google The Cactus Surgeon, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and my website is thecactussurgeon.com. And anyone that signs up by the end of June will get a free copy of The Green Recovery, which is an ebook.
Brilliant.
And then my full memoir will come out in September, October.
Excellent.
Just finishing writing it now.
I don't think there's any other cactus surgeons out there, so they'll probably find you easily.
No, I don't think so. Hopefully not.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Hannah.
The healing power of plants and gardens is undeniable. It's just so uplifting to hear Hannah's story and to hear how being at one with nature and getting outside makes such a positive difference to her health. If you're looking for a way to celebrate the joy of gardens, then take part in the Candide Festival of Flowers. This is an online event, a floral takeover throughout the whole month of May. Head to candidegardening.com to join in the fun. Until next time, happy gardening.